Hello and welcome to the EDH RecCast. My name is Joey Schultz and I'm joined as always by my fantastic co-hosts. First up, he loves the change from converted mana cost to the term mana value. It's Matt Morgan.
So it turns out Albert Einstein was a real person, and here I always thought he was just a theoretical physicist.
Ooh, well done, Matt. A plus on that. Of the dad jokes you done, that one tickles me the most I love it.
That's saying a lot because I've gotten you good lately.
You really have, but I appreciate that one on more than just a making me laugh level. Like, what a great start. I love it. Anyway, up next, he doesn't love mana value so much as he is a man of value. That's Dana Roach.
When we got our first preview card back in 2019, Aeon Engine, Joey did a little preview video for it where it turns out not only did he reveal the card to the world, he correctly predicted Universes Beyond by mixing in Uno cards with Magic. So, well played, Joey.
Ooh, deep cut there, Dana. That is delightful. Anyway, this is the EDH RecCast. EDH Rec is the best deck building resource on the web for the Commander format, compiling data from deck lists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for your new Commander decks. And here on the podcast, what we like to do is give all of that data a little more context. Hey, Dana, what is it that we're talking about this week?
Today, we're going to be talking about the biggest set surges in EDH.
That is right. We're looking at the sets that had the biggest impact on Commander about a month after they came out. What were the numbers looking like when those sets came out? How big of an impact did they have on EDH right out the gate? It should be a whole lot of fun. But before we get there, we want to pause and give a huge thank you to the folks at the Command Zone podcast who handle all of the post-production work on our podcast here, making it look as awesome as it does. And of course, we want to thank our sponsors for the show too.
The EDH RecCast is sponsored by Card Kingdom and TCG Player. You can send in an entire stack of absolute jank 10-cent cards at Card Kingdom, get store credit, and do what I do, which is to buy an absolute stack of janky 10-cent foil cards to put into your decks. TCG Player also has access to any single at any time, any condition. So if you are looking for whatever kind of janky card you possibly want, one of our two sponsors will have it. Just go to EDH Rec and click on the card in question, choose the vendor link down below, and doing so supports both the site and the show.
And if you would prefer to support the show directly, you can do so over at patreon.com/EDHRecCast. We have Patreon tiers of all sorts of levels, whether you want to join the Discord community that we have going, or you want to see all the episodes a day early. We have many different levels of whatever goal you're looking to achieve. We even have a special tier for patrons that we're going to give a shout out to every single week. And this week, we want to give a very hearty shout out to Trevor McCarthy. Thank you so much for all of your support for the show. We definitely appreciate it.
All right, guys, let's get into our main topic. And as we do move into this main topic, let's also set some ground rules for what it is that we are talking about and what it is that we're not really talking about. To give sort of a timeline for the number of sets that we're going to be looking at for the purposes of figuring out their impact within the 1 month window when they came out, we are going to draw a line just sort of within the past 2 years. So back to 2019, starting with War of the Spark. We're not going to go all the way back to Alpha. We just want to see sort of the sets within the past 2 years, because those are definitely the most current ones right now.
Yeah, and this count is going to count decks that have been updated as well, not just brand new decks that have been built on any of the given sites, whether it's Archidect or Moxfield or any of the deck building sites that we do pull from. Anything can be updated, even if it's just a single card. The same rule applies to the entire website in general, but we're just going to talk about these specific numbers here for the sake of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't have to be a new deck. It can also be an updated deck. Definitely a good thing for us to note. We are also, to kind of explain the process a little bit here, what we've done is took a 1 month window after each set's release. And then we looked at the total number of decks that were built within that 1 month window. And we then kind of compared that to the total number of decks that were built within that window that contain at least one card that came from that set. So if we're talking about specifically Commander Legends, for instance, we'd be looking at the total number of decks that were built after Commander Legends came out, about a month window there, but then also the total number of decks that were built after Commander Legends came out that contain a Commander Legends card. So that is what we're measuring here. We want to see what that percentage difference looks like to see which set had the most impact relative to the huge surge in decks that came out 1 month after its release. So again, remember, we are talking about deck counts here, not total card counts. That is what we're looking at. And what I figure we'll do is start from the lowest percentage and move up to the highest. That way we can see which of the sets had the biggest impact on deck building 1 month after their release.
We're also not including reprint-only sets like Double Masters or Mystery Boosters. Since those are entirely reprints, there's a pretty good chance they would wind up with a score of 100% anyway. That's not terribly useful to this conversation.
Yeah. We do want to just see the sets that had a bunch of new stuff to provide that impact. Reprints do definitely affect a set's numbers, but something that is all reprints, it's not really a fair competition. So yeah, good thing to note there too. All right, fellas, let's get into it. We're going to start off with the set that had the least impact 1 month after its release, and that turns out to be, drum roll please, Ikoria, of all things. So this is the set that had all of those companions, which was a big deal. It had all of those mutants. It had those ultimatums, all of those. So here's what the numbers kind of break down to. There were over 18,000 decks that were either updated or brand new added to the site in the month after Ikoria came out, but only 7,400 of those decks contained at least one card from Ikoria. So that is a rate of about 40% of the decks built in the month after Ikoria's release contained Ikoria cards. That's where we're starting, 40% for Ikoria, which I don't know about you guys, but I feel like that's a lot lower than I expected it to be.
I mean, this isn't too surprising just because a lot of the set was like very, very specific and almost parasitic, where if you weren't playing something like a mutate themed deck, a lot of the cards that you might consider putting in probably weren't going to be added anyways or cycling. So everything was, it was really specific and kind of, you needed to be playing on a theme. And so if you weren't playing a theme, Ikoria may not have had anything for you.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think if you're just thinking in terms of power, Ikoria jumps out as being a strong set. But once you kind of drill down, you realize, oh, it is a, you know, three color set, which means a lot of the cards didn't really have a chance to even show up in a two-color or a one-color deck. And, you know, things like the ultimatums that are very, very strong also have a really heavy pip count. So maybe they can't show up in a five-color deck where they're difficult to cast. So there's just these kind of weird conditions in a lot of the Ikoria cards that make them kind of difficult to show up outside a very specific deck.
Well, and it kind of shows like this, the set maybe didn't make the impact that a lot of people were excited to see.
Yeah, and I especially love the point that you brought up about them being parasitic. Like if one Ikoria deck contains a lot of Ikoria cards, we're still only counting that as one deck, but one Ikoria deck that contains all of the mutants, for example, that's going to contain a lot of Ikoria cards for sure. So that's another thing for us to sort of remember about this set. But yeah, 40%, that's where we're starting. The numbers are going to go up from here. I tell you what, let's move to the next most impactful set. That is Theros Beyond Death. There were, again, about 18,000 decks built in the month after Theros came out, and 11,000, almost 12,000 of them contained a card from Theros Beyond Death. So that puts its number at about 60%. So 60% of the decks built the month after Theros came out contained Theros Beyond Death cards. Ooh, what a doozy here. That is a little bit bigger. There are some cool cards from Theros, like the gods, for example, that could lead to a bit of inclusion. But again, it is still a little bit low compared to some of the other ones that we'll talk about later on.
This is an example of where the power kind of makes sense. Generally speaking, I think Theros Beyond Death is considered slightly less powerful than a lot of the sets around it. So while it's easier to put these cards into decks in Ikoria, since a lot of them are one or two colors, they're also a little bit less powerful, I would say, on average, than a lot of the cards and sets we're going to see coming up afterwards. So this one logically makes sense. Of all the sets that are easier to put cards from them into decks, this one's just a little bit weaker.
I also think that like there's some sort of effect of, if you told people Theros Beyond Death came out in the past 2 years, you'd probably get a, oh yeah, I guess it did kind of response.
Right.
Like, I feel like this set, I enjoyed it, but overall, I think just the circumstances around the release of the set really downplayed the amount of people that were just getting to play with these cards. And so, the numbers do reflect that a little bit.
Yeah, but this is still the set that contained some honest bangers. Like, it had Thassa's Oracle, it had Nyx Bloom Ancient, but it is still, you know, the numbers are a little bit more depressed down in what they could be compared to some of the other stuff that we're going to get to. So let's get to those. Let's keep on going up there. Moving on here, War of the Spark is next. Surprise, surprise. In the month after War of the Spark was released, there were about 12,000 decks either added to the database or updated within the database, and about 7,600 of those contained War of the Spark cards. So the War of the Spark's percentage, it had a 63% rating there. That was about its level of impact. A little bit over half of the decks that were built in the month after War of the Spark contained War of the Spark cards, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, now this is one I thought would perhaps be a little bit higher just because this was a set that had all of those planeswalkers, you know, planeswalkers at rare, planeswalkers at uncommon, many of which that did, you know, fairly interesting niche things. I thought you would see this just accidentally populate decks enough to kind of overinflate the number, so to speak. Like, there are some sets where you expect new decks to wind up with two or three or four cards because there's just so many really good cards. I thought this would be kind of the go wide equivalent of a expansion where there was just so many of those planeswalkers that were useful. You would see decks where someone just included one of them. But that wound up not being the case. This one is very, very low on our list. So my guess would have been very wrong here with War of the Spark.
Well, and when we joke that we say every set since War of the Spark has been War of the Spark, like, this is, it's kind of true because War of the Spark is third on the list of all the sets that we have to talk about. And we were extremely excited about War of the Spark when it was coming out. There's there's some cards we haven't even talked about, like Dovin's Veto is a very, very powerful card. Feather, like, there's a lot of just very, very powerful effects and cards in War of the Spark. And the numbers as far as adoption rates are only going to get higher moving forward.
Yeah, this is the set that had Finale of Devastation. I mean, the Matt Morganist card out there, Finale of Devastation.
That is pretty high up on the list of Matt Morgan-y cards. You are 100% correct there.
All right, let's move now to the next one in line. This is Modern Horizons. About 11,000, sort of, give or take, decks were built in the month after Modern Horizons came out, and 7,300 of those decks contained at least one Modern Horizons card, so its percentage is about 64%, just a little bit higher than War of the Spark. This is, of course, the set that had such amazing cards as, like, the Talismans, for example. We finally completed the enemy color Talismans. There was a continuation of the Horizon lands in this set. So if anything, this is one of those sets where I'm like, whoa, that's not higher?
Yeah, and this is also the first set that we're going to talk about here that has a relatively significant amount of reprints in it. Mm-hmm. Something that should help artificially boost the numbers of a set, and it's still quite low on our list, which probably means it's realistically much lower in terms of adoption of new cards at the very least.
Well, and especially when you consider some of those new cards are the Talismans. Like, everybody was just jonesing to have the enemy color Talismans that we finally did get in this set, which they're great. They're played in a healthy amount of cards. But then when you get kind of towards the outside the top 10, I should say, that's when the numbers really start to dwindle. And
yeah,
I'm kind of surprised to see it this low, honestly.
Now, I do think this is one of those sets too where pricing is going to do weird things. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some very good commander cards in this set. You know, we talked about Urza. There's the Force of Will kind of equivalent cycle, most of which are very good in commander. The Yawgmoth himself is a really solid card too. But a lot of those were also very expensive cards because they were getting played in other formats, particularly modern. So I think we might see some of that impacting here too, where the price just made people not run cards from this set that they otherwise would have ran because they're good.
That's an excellent observation. I really like that. And you mentioned there too, the reprint sets. The next couple of sets coming here are also ones that contain a big number of reprints, which might be influencing their numbers a little bit. We're going to start talking about some core sets. So Core Set 2020 is next in our list. About 11,000 decks were built in the month after Core Set 2020 came out, and just about 7,200 of them contain cards from that core set. So that gives it about a 65% impact. 65% of the decks built the month after Core Set 2020 came out contain at least one card from Core Set 2020. But this is, again, While it is the set that contains Golos, Tireless Pilgrim, and Yarok, the Desecrated, it is also one that includes a lot of sort of staples among the format that got reprinted here, you know, such as the Temples cycle.
I mean, if you've seen the top commanders of all time, I would guess that 60% of the 65 decks here that were built or updated are just Golos decks. Probably not too far off.
Sure.
Just Golos, how popular that commander got in such a short amount of time is absolutely insane. But I don't think that makes, obviously, the entire impact of the set.
I do think, though, it's worth noting here, that much penetration of the format for a core set was something that would have been unheard of, you know, 4 years, 5 years ago, when core sets were very much not built with Commander in mind. There was, you know, I remember going over spoilers for things like M15 and just being like, well, there's two cards I want from this whole set. That's not a thing anymore. When we get these core sets, they are deep in terms of Commander playable cards. So the numbers are low, but for a core set, it's a pretty huge improvement compared to where we were not many years ago.
There are core sets post 2019 are like the original, they have the equivalents of some of the original Commander precons.
Yeah,
like,
yes.
Let's be real. They have a similar interest and intrigue for us as Commander players. That's what core sets are doing nowadays. It's absolutely insane. And in fact, the next one on our list here is another core set 2021, which had about a 69% impact, I would say, because it is about 21,000 decks total, which is a really big surge, I'll actually note. 21,000 decks total were built or updated in the month after Core Set 2021 was released. 14,500 of those contained a card from Core Set 2021. So again, that gives it that 69% rating, give or take. That's the set that includes Rin and Sari. Some of the shrines were here, so it is a little bit bigger than the Core Set. But again, it is another Core Set that still has a lot of really entertaining stuff for us as Commander players.
Well, this set, kind of like what Dana pointed out about Core Set 2020, where it was designed with Commander in mind, this one to me felt even more juiced because you had Heroic Intervention, you had Azusa, you had just all sorts of these awesome reprints. And like, if you give people a chance to buy $6 Azusas, they're probably going to do that. People love playing more lands. People love good protection spells, and Heroic Intervention is one of the best. So this set, I was very excited about. I'm not surprised to see it outpacing the previous years.
Yeah, this is a good example of a set where the reprints very much made cards available for players financially in a way that they weren't prior to this. It made it a lot easier to find that Heroic Intervention for your deck. Absolutely. So even if things like core sets didn't maybe give new cards to established players, these were an absolute boon for newer players who weren't around when Heroic Intervention was a, you know, dollar card or something. These are a big deal, I think, for a lot of new players. And even though they're not in the top half of cards that added things to Commander, it's really good for the format to have core sets showing up in these numbers at all.
Well, Dana, you said something there where you were like, even if it didn't offer as much to a franchise player, I might be misparaphrasing you a little bit there, but like, this core set, I feel like it did offer a whole lot to franchise players.
Compared to the ones we're going to get into in the next 10 minutes or so, it doesn't. But yes, those are really, really extraordinary numbers for a core set to offer that many Commander cards, for sure.
Are you just trying to, because this is the set that had Fiery Emancipation in it. Mm-hmm. Are you just trying to downplay
Yes, I am, just because of that card that I now have in three decks, I believe.
Yeah, I know, of all of us, you're the one who's actually playing that card that you weren't as impressed by when it first came out, but you're the only one who's added it to the decks of the three of us. And like, it's a good card, man. That's what I'm trying to say.
Anyway, it's fine.
Let's move on to the next one. Our next one here is, again, reprint heavy, but in a new way. This is Jumpstart. Jumpstart, month after that one was, after that set was released, 17,500 decks were either created or updated within that month, and 12,700 of them contained cards from Jumpstart. So that puts its rating at 72%. We're talking about the Tiny Boneses, we're talking about the Naiths, but we're also talking about a lot of reprints in this set too.
That number is quite extraordinary when you think about how difficult Jumpstart was to get in the month after it was released.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. If Jumpstart were widely available like a Core Set 2020 would have been, I think these numbers would have been significantly higher, especially with all the new cards that people wanted, but just logistically couldn't get a copy of.
Yeah, even for somebody like myself, who usually is quite impatient to add new cards for decks, it was difficult to get ones from this set. So if you're somebody who isn't like clicking refresh madly on one of our sponsors, Card Kingdom or TCG Player, trying to find those cards, you just weren't going to be updating your deck. So yeah, I think these numbers are probably artificially depressed compared to what they would have been in a normal year.
Well, and especially like that number there, the 72%, like that impact actually kind of really hits me in an interesting way. Like I have a feeling about that number because the reprints in Jumpstart were stellar. Mm-hmm. They just also weren't as available as they should have been, even in Collation to an extent too. But like you had your Rhystic Studies, you had your Oracle of Moldiah's in this set. And so the fact is also that some of the reprints from the set are kind of artificially increasing our numbers at the same time that they are being depressed by the real world circumstances that surrounded this set's release. But it just, that doesn't undervalue the set at all to me. Like hearing that 72%, I'm just like, yeah, there were so many good cards that were printed in Jumpstart. It just sort of reveals to me how important a lot of those reprints could have been.
Well, and we know Wizards of the Coast listens to us every single week. They never miss an episode. So hearing this, hopefully they hear that and think that, you know, or reminded, I guess I should say, that Jumpstart was a great set. It was a great idea. Hopefully they do it again. They're doing another Modern Horizons, which is lower on this list, and they do love us Commander players. So hopefully we get a Jumpstart 2.0, Jumpstart Boogaloo, or whatever they're going to call it. But it was a fantastic set, and I do hope we see it again.
Me too. All right, let's take a brief pause before we get to the most impactful sets. Let's pause and challenge some stats. It is one of our favorite segments here on the show because there's just so much data on EDH Rec, but you know, we don't always agree with it. Sometimes I think that cards see too much play or maybe too little play. So we like to challenge those stats in this segment. Dana, do you want to start us off with your challenge? What is it this week?
My challenge is a relatively new card, Idol of Oblivion. It's a 2-mana artifact that you can tap to draw a card, and you can only activate this ability if you created a token this turn. But that isn't restricted to your turn. You can just tap it at any point in time when you've made a token. You can also spend 8 mana to sacrifice it and create a 10/10 colorless Eldrazi token. That's something you kind of do late in the game when you just need a way to win. But this is a really good draw effect in particular in Boros or mono white or mono red decks that make tokens. It's only in just under 6,000 decks, and there's a good amount of red and white commanders that just by default, those decks themselves make tokens, let alone what other things in the deck that are tying into that strategy. But Zersoth, the Chaos Rider, is a mono red commander. Only about a third of those decks are running it. God Eternal Aketra is a pretty strong mono white commander that has the ability to make tokens right into the command, right on the text there. Only about a third of those decks are running Idol of Oblivion. Darien, King of Keldor, same thing. 17% of those decks, and it's a commander that just makes tokens. I would say if you are playing something in, like I said, Boros or mono red or mono white, and you're making tokens, this is a really, really strong card. It's very efficient. It's going to put cards into your hand. And it's got kind of a win condition baked into the deck late in the game when you just need a body to clock somebody for 10 damage. You can do it.
Well, Dana, and you mentioning all of those, I'm thinking about commanders that make tokens. Matt, you've got a Valda, Keeper of the Flame deck, and that makes a lot of tokens, and they hurt me a lot, but like that could also be potentially another good example. Do you think Idol of Oblivion would be a fun one for Valduk there? Like, I feel like that's a good example.
I do actually, now that I'm thinking about it, having an engine card like that at a fairly low CMC, and it's just doing things that the deck's going to do anyways. Yeah, that's a really good option. It's a really good thought. I like this challenge, and it's a card that I think a lot of players just kind of overlook because they don't think, well, I'm not in a dedicated token deck. But then incidentally, you know, they're playing a bunch of cards that do make some sort of token. So this is a really good find.
And so, Matt, how about you take us to your challenge?
Well, my challenge this week comes from a patron of ours who went over to patreon.com/EDHRecCast and signed up to actually be able to contribute to the Challenge of Stats segment every single week. So Crystal, we appreciate your support. And this week, I really, really am digging your challenge of stats that you gave us. So Crystal pointed out that Stubborn Denial is only played in 44 of the over 2,400 Elsha of the Infinite decks. Now, Elsha of the Infinite is the Jeskai commander with prowess. You can play cards off the top of your library. It is quite the combo machine, but sometimes you got to protect your combos. And that's what Stubborn Denial does. So Stubborn Denial is just a force spike. It is one blue mana, counter target non-creature spell, unless they pay one. It doesn't seem that great, but when you consider there's a ferocious clause on there, so if you control a creature that has a power four or greater, which turns into being just as long as Elsha's on the battlefield, it just turns into a straight one mana negate, which is counter target non-creature spell. It is insanely powerful when you consider that if you have Elsha the Infinite on the battlefield, since yes, Elsha is a 3-3, but with the prowess trigger, when you cast Stubborn Denial, Elsha becomes a 4-4, which triggers the ferocious clause on Stubborn Denial, which makes it a one mana negate. Now, negate is already being played in 741 decks that are Elsha the Infinite decks, which for half the mana, you can get the exact same spell as long as your commander's out, which seems like a pretty great upgrade to me. So this is a really solid find. I happen to love Stubborn Denial, so seeing it, or at least another place that the card could be getting a little more play, is always a welcome sight. So good find, Crystal. Definitely I'm digging this one.
That's such a good suggestion. I sometimes take for granted how much I love Stubborn Denial. I know that people really like Swan Song, but man, Stubborn Denial has been my favorite counter spell for a really, really long time, because I do tend to play a couple of those decks where they get a very naturally very large creature. So I love this as a form of protection. And that is a really good potential oversight on the thing, because you see, oh, the three powers. So it might not work with Stubborn Denial, but it totally does because of the prowess. So I love this.
Yeah, Shu Yun Silent Tempest is another commander that Stubborn Denial is just very, very good in.
Well, it's also one of those spells where, like, sometimes you think to yourself, well, what if I don't have the creature out to put it over the top to actually make it a hard counter? Then you think about it and go, well, am I in a position where a counter spell matters at that point anyway? Mm-hmm. Like, that's something I found in my Sphinx deck. If I have no Sphinxes in play, I'm probably at a point in the game where me countering a spell isn't going to salvage things.
Right. The spells that you want to counter tend to be the ones that would get rid of your four power or greater creature.
Exactly.
So you save it for exactly that moment. So it's perfect. Ah, I love that one. That's a really, really great one. All right, I'm going to move to my challenge now. I have a card that I think is a little bit overplayed in its commander deck. I'm looking at the card Balduvian Rage in Feather the Redeemed decks. Feather, of course, we all know and love, or if you're Dana, hate Feather the Redeemed, because he's a curmudgeon who doesn't like how many cards that this Boros commander can actually draw you, because Feather can reclaim all of your tiny cantrips that target creatures that you control. Balduvian Rage is supposed to fit into that mold. It is a one mana instant that says target attacking creature gets plus X plus O until end of turn, and then you'll draw a card at the beginning of the next turn's end step. Next turn's upkeep, excuse me. So it is actually a one mana instant technically, but it is a X and one mana. So you can pay extra mana to give your commander a bigger boost if you want to, but that rarely happens. The point of this card is supposed to be that you can attack with something, and then you can use the Balduvian Rage even just for one mana to get that card draw trigger on the next upkeep. This is seeing play in about 33% of Feather decks, but I actually don't really, I don't like that restriction on it, because there actually is one here where you have to target an attacking creature. And of course, Feather wants it to be a creature that you control. That attacking thing, while it is an instant, you're not getting to take advantage of that multiple times around. And there are plenty of turns, in my experience with Feather, where you actually don't want to attack. You need to leave her back to defend against someone else who's got a really, really big attacker. So this is technically a card draw spell, but it kind of forces your hand in a way that you might not be as comfortable with. I think that 33% is a little bit too high, and that you might be better served finding some other options, even potentially at sorcery speed, that can let you repeatedly draw cards without forcing you to be aggressive in doing so. So Balduvian Rage and Feather, that is my challenge.
Seems wise, somebody who's played the deck a couple times, a handful of times, at twitch.tv/edhretcast. I think we can probably trust your judgment there.
Nice. Matt, I thought that you were just going to give me grief because I don't like attacking nearly as much as you do, so I'm saying remove a card that specifies attacking.
Well, that too. I mean, it always is fun to pull a Dana Roach and use target attacking creature type spells on someone else's attacking creature when it happens to be attacking somebody else. The amount of times Dana's killed somebody with a Berserk because the attacking creature wasn't his own. Too high.
It's good.
Too high.
It is indeed. It is a delightful cruelty, Dana. So thank you for all of those moments. Absolutely. All right, let's get back into our main topic. We left off with Jumpstart, and our next set in terms of popularity of impact, the next one we're going to talk about, it's Throne of Eldraine. So for Throne of Eldraine, in the month after that set came out, about 12,600 decks total were either updated or created within that 1 month period after the set, and 10,600 of those decks contained at least one card from Throne of Eldraine. So that puts its number at 84%. That is a 12% jump up from Jumpstart. We're talking about 84%. That is big. That is splashy. We're talking about the set that had, you know, the Kenriths and the Korvolds and the Arcane Signet, hint, hint, hint. So that number's very, very big.
Yeah, not that there aren't a ton of really interesting cards here. I mean, the Great Henge is backbreaking. you know, it's an insane card. Mystic Sanctuary messed up Eternal formats. You know, there's just so many bombs here. However, I would be curious to see what the stats look like without Arcane Signet mixed in, because it's a mana rock that kind of literally goes in every deck in terms of raw power. I feel like that alone is pretty warping.
I mean, this set in general is just, this was when we kind of saw 60 card formats and standard start to get a little warped, as in majorly warped. You had stuff like Once Upon a Time, even, that was just a free spell, and free spells are never broken.
Oh my goodness.
But just this set, like, it's kind of synonymous with power creep. So the fact that we're starting off the second half of the show with Throne of Eldraine, like, it's a sign of things to come, people.
Return of the Wildspeaker is one of the best green draw spells ever printed, and it's not the best green draw spell in Throne of Eldraine.
Here's actually, so I want to go back to the Arcane Signet thing that you mentioned, Dana. Remember that the way that Arcane Signet was introduced to the world was in pre-con decks.
Yes.
Brawl pre-con decks. So they were not actually widely accessible. So I would argue that the 1 month window that we're looking at immediately after Throne of Eldraine came out may not have even been super influenced by Arcane Signet in the way that it would be nowadays, because Arcane Signet was finally reprinted in a bit more accessible mass release set, Commander Legends. So I think that it is actually still not all Arcane Signet's fault there for the 84%.
I think it's not, it's completely its fault, but it's also, imagine what the numbers would have been if Arcane Signet were in the set proper.
Oh,
I think we're talking probably like a top two or three set instead of just starting off the second half.
Yeah. And so, Matt, as you said, this is definitely a sign of things to come. Let's move on. The next set in line here, 1 month after its release, to measure that percentage, it's actually Kaldheim. So in the 1 month that Kaldheim has been around, 18,000 decks have been created or updated, and 15,705 of those decks have contained cards from Kaldheim. That is a rate of 86%. So all of those new cards, all of those new gods, your Turgrids, your Orvar, your Vorinclexes, your new Pathways, the Snow Duel Lands, Kaldheim is doing business in Commander, even just after 1 month.
We can't even say it's a recency bias, because we've had that first full month, the same as every other set. It was... We praised the amount of powerful cards in Kaldheim. It is not surprising to see this up there. I mean, like you said, there's just so many good cards for nearly every deck. You have the Pathways. Anytime you have a good rare land cycle, that's going to help the numbers. But then, man, just having the dual face cards in general, there's a just lot of just awesome moderate upgrades for nearly every deck. Like if you have a creature deck, you probably got an upgrade because of Changelings.
Mm.
Yeah, this is also, you know, we've looked at one or two of these sets that came with a couple of those commander decks that were primarily reprints. At least for me personally, this was the first set where there were also singles of the couple of new cards in these sets that I wanted for decks. Cosmic Intervention, for one, that jumps out at me. That was a card that I wanted from those precons for a deck. And that was a new thing for those heavy reprint precons that we would get two ofs in sets. Kaldheim also had really solid cards in those as well.
Oh yeah, Pact of the Serpent, the new tribal draw spell from the elf precon. I love that thing. I'm even putting that in a deck that isn't specifically tribal. I'm putting it in a token deck because I make a lot of spirits with Thalise the Reverend Medium. So I'm just like, this seems like a really great way to draw a bunch of cards. I love that thing.
Yeah, this wound up very much being kind of the go wide set in terms of filling slots. There's just a ton of different ways that this managed to put cards into decks.
Moving on now to our next one here is Zendikar Rising. 15,500 decks were created in the month after Zendikar Rising, and 13,600 of them contained cards from Zendikar Rising. That gives it 87% in terms of that impact. Again, this does include the Commander Precon, so we are not just talking about the new Omnath, we're also hitting that new Anowon and Obun Precons too. And of course, all of those phenomenal MDFC modal double-faced cards, including the lands, including the spells. Lots to unpack here with Zendikar Rising.
I mean, it turns out when you put a regrowth that has the backside to actually be able to be a land, that's going to get a lot of play. I would venture of the 87% adoption rate for Zendikar Rising, 86% of it is just from one card. Maybe.
Come on.
Well, and we've also talked in the past about how popular as a theme landfall is. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of landfall decks out there that got cards from this set. And there was a ton of things in this set that would encourage those last 12% of people who didn't have landfall decks to make their first one.
That's definitely true. I actually kind of suspected personally when I was like getting all the data stuff together for this, I suspected that Zendikar Rising might be a little bit lower because there is kind of a tribal theme going on in it, especially with rogues going on. But then landfall is, while a very popular strategy, is still a little bit, it can sometimes be a bit of a parasitic one. So just like we saw with Ikoria, I thought that maybe those cards would all be sort of compounded into the same decks rather than being a big spread. But no, Zendikar Rising is still, like, it's got a whole bunch of stuff proliferating all across the decks that were being made at that time.
It's not proliferating. It's putting counters, but
that was not in the set, Joe. You're thinking of War of the Spark with that one.
Come on. But I mean, you think about, like, Skewt Swarm and all these other just great, powerful cards in the set. Like, the more you think about it, you're like, okay, yeah, that card was in the set. Okay, that was in the set, too. So, like, I found myself doing that a lot with the new Zendikar set.
Well, right, and you know, we talked about early on with Ikoria how, you know, some mechanics like Mutate are a little bit parasitic. You're probably not putting Mutate as a mechanic in a deck that isn't really heavily built around Mutate. Landfall is a thing that is very easy to trigger even if you're not playing a landfall deck. Things like Felidar Retreat, you know, even if you're playing mono white, you're still playing a land per turn, hopefully, and getting that trigger. And if you're playing something like Selesnya, where you have access to green's additional ramp, it's not a landfall deck, but you can very often get multiple triggers off that per turn. So it's a mechanic that plays really well in decks that aren't just specifically focused on doing landfall things.
I just need you guys to know, since you so rudely corrected me earlier, I'm going to be proliferating extra poison counters on each of you.
No, Joey, you're wrong again. That's Finn the Fangbearer that has the poison counters. Still doesn't.
Dang it, Matthew. Okay,
sorry. I'm just keeping you honest, friend.
Oh man. All right, let's move now to our top three. Here we're looking at Commander 2020. 17,777 decks total were built in the month after Commander 2020 was released, and 15,900 of those decks contained at least one card from Commander 2020. So, you know, this is the set that had your Fierce Guardianships, your Deflecting Swats, but then also those big bangers like Kalamex, your Zaxara. That is an 89% inclusion rate within the month after Commander 2020 was released. Holy whoa.
It's a set that was also competing for attention with the Ikoria set that came out at the exact same time. So that, I feel like, is also challenging those numbers a little bit, since people had a whole lot of cards they had to pick up if they wanted to completely update their decks, and it still hit almost 90% penetration. That is crazy.
Well, and the Fierce Guardianship cycle, the you can cast these spells for free as long as you control your commander, all of those are just extremely powerful, and you wanted them in any given deck as long as you're playing those colors, because they were great. They're just insanely powerful, insanely useful. So those, like, I would venture are a significant percentage, but then also just there's so many good role players. And if you're building anything kind of on those themes, it wasn't like regular Aquaria where it was almost parasitic, like we said, but it also was just, there were so many just all-stars and just haymakers to be played too.
So moving on to number two, we have another very commander-focused set. You might notice that pattern here happening with our top three. Commander Legends is next. 17,600 decks were built in the month after Commander Legends, and 16,800 of those decks contained Commander Legends cards. So that's a 95% hit rate that we're talking about there. You've got your Obekas, your Aurelmies, your AC, the Tyrant of Gyra Strait. In this case, we are counting since there were only the two precons there. Those are combined into the Commander Legends data that we're measuring here. But then you, of course, had your Hull Breachers, your Opposition Agents, your Jeweled Lotuses, and as if that all wasn't enough, this is also the set that had all of those new Bond Land cycle finishing itself out too. A lot happening at Commander Legends. 95%, you guys. Holy whoa.
And like, this is a set brewed specifically to hit those numbers. It was engineered to be a commander set with maximum penetration. You know, existing decks wanted to add Bond Lands. Existing decks wanted to add really good role players like Jessica's Will or Akroma's Will. There was a ton of new commanders to make people want to brew brand new decks. There's bombs like Jeweled Lotus to push like really aggressive, highly competitive decks over the top. There's a little bit of everything here. No matter how you play or what you do, there was something in Commander Legends to make you pick up singles.
Well, and so we're over 95% adoption rate. I would wager the 5% of decks that were updated or created after Commander Legends came out that weren't playing those cards were people like me where they realized, oh, I haven't put my list up online. I better do that.
Sure,
and they just hadn't updated Commander Legends cards into that deck yet. So it's such a high thing. Like, you almost have to kind of go out of your way to not be playing some of the new cards or even a lot of the reprints that came in Commander Legends.
See, this is the set where I'm like, I want to see what these numbers would look like without Arcane Signet. This is the one where I'm like, what would have happened were Arcane Signet not a thing in this instance? Because Arcane Signet is one of the big reprints from this set.
But you also have stuff like Swords to Plowshares and other just very, very powerful cards that qualify as staples of the format that just happen to get reprinted as well. Like, I think, sure, it would make a decent contribution to the number, but I don't think it's going to push it down to even third place.
Well, and even then, like, there's a piece in my brain where I'm just like, well, doesn't that kind of artificially inflate the numbers because of the reprints? And I'm just like, no, the reprints, again, are really important here. The fact that those reprints are so popular and so prolific within our format is the point. We want more sets that do that. We want more sets that have the reprints to keep those prices down so that we can put them into all of our decks.
Yeah, as important as the reprints that you pointed out for Jumpstart were, The same thing applies here for Commander Legends. They just knocked it out of the park when it comes to making sure that there are solid reprints that are making things more available for players, but also new and interesting cards that are going to make their way into the format.
Mm-hmm. And so that leaves us with our number one, the most impactful set for the EDH format in the month after it was released. That leaves us with only one more remaining here. It's Commander 2019. 12,700 decks total were built in the month after Commander 2019 was released, and 12,480 of them contained cards that were printed or reprinted or whatever within Commander 2019. This is the set that had your Kyrix, your Dockside Extortionists. It had cool commanders like Atla Palani and Miss Ange Falconwrath. This set had a 97% rate, 97% hit rate for the stuff that was just within this cycle of Commander Precons. Ooh, I'm blown away that this one beat out Commander Legends.
Yeah, this one is shocking. When I think of Commander Legends, I think of those really solid role player cards that I wound up stuffing three or four of in literally every one of my decks. There's a lot of good cards in Commander 2019, but they, at least mentally for me, I think of commanders first. I don't think of those war rooms that I put into every single one or two color deck, or that Akroma's Will that I stuffed into almost every white deck I have that wants to be attacking. It feels like a set with a bunch of good commanders, and I'm really having a tough time coming up with what that good utility card would be outside of Dockside Extortionist, which is insanely broken.
Well, and one thing that's interesting that I kind of noticed was the sample size of Commander 2019 compared to Commander Legends is significantly smaller. Like there's almost a 5,000 deck difference as far as decks that were created or updated after Commander 2019 compared to the almost 18,000 for Commander Legends. So I think if the sample size were a little bit larger, I'm curious if the numbers would be a little bit lower as far as cards from Commander 2019 making it into decks right off the bat. I think the very, very high percentage as far as what we're seeing here, that might be just largely due to the new commanders that kind of spawned a lot of decks. I know Angie Falconrath was very, very popular out of the gates. Kirik, a lot of people were rushing to build those decks. So I think the new commanders might be pushing a lot of the high numbers that we're seeing here.
Well, so there is also an important point. Like there is a reason that so many commander-focused products are also having inflated numbers here too. And that is because Sol Ring appears in rather a number of these. And I feel like I can already hear someone typing in the comments, it's just like, guys, you forgot about Sol Ring. No, we didn't forget about Sol Ring. We're talking about it now. But like that is also true of a lot of the other sets that we've talked about too. Kaldheim was much lower on this list. It had a good number, but it also was connected to the data that we got from precons, and Sol Rings were in those precons too. So Sol Ring is not 100% the answer here. It is definitely a factor that allowed these to move into the latter half of the show for sure, increase their numbers because Sol Ring is so omnipresent. Command Tower is so omnipresent, but that's true for a lot of the sets that we've talked about so far. Sol Ring can only pull so much weight, and a lot of the other stuff happening in Commander 2019 was pulling a lot of the rest of that weight, and that's a really important point for us to hit on here.
Well, even if you consider like Command Tower being in all these sets, Throne of Eldraine was still 12% higher on these ratings than Jumpstart. So even if you figure Command Tower occupies 12% of these scores, you know, 97% minus 12 is still 85%, which is still significantly higher than Jumpstart. So I think, yes, it is playing into the fact that these numbers are higher. But also, if you take Command Tower and I'm guessing Sol Ring out of the equation, these numbers still are going to be significantly higher than the first half of the sets that we talked about.
Yeah, very much. So with all of that, having looked at all of those sets and the crazy impact that so many of these different products had, let's wrap up with some final thoughts about it. And man, Matt, you just hit on something there that I kind of want to speak to, is just that like the numbers are so high. Like we started with like 40%, which is like, give or take a 40%. I could have totally seen a situation where we had done this episode and a lot of the data stuck around the 40, 50, maybe 60% mark or something. But no, they reached up into the 70s and the 80s kind of pretty quickly. Like that is the level of impact that we're seeing from every set as soon as it comes out. Like they're hitting the ground running. We are getting a lot of impact on the decks that we build every time that one of these sets comes out, which is probably why it feels a little bit exhausting to keep up with in some ways, but also just like every one of those sets, it just is banger after banger. And it wasn't down in the 40% rate or anything like that. We swiftly got up to like 80% or 90%. Like it was, that is the takeaway for me here, is just how very impactful all of these sets were.
Well, the sample sizes too that we saw, I mean, we compared the number one set compared to the number two, and the growth of the format over the past 2 years, just with how many decks we're seeing created within the time that a set's coming out, is insane. Like there are so many new players for the format, and just the way that, you know, Wizards of the Coast is designing cards for those new players, like it's obviously pulling people into the format. Whatever they're doing is obviously working.
The one thing I'd like to kind of single out here, and I guess statistically, I don't know how we would validate this, but Commander Legends obviously made a splash, but I have a feeling that's the set that's going to be making a splash the longest time from now. You know, a lot of these sets were reliant on splashy new commanders to gain penetration. Someone saw this new cool card, wanted to build a deck around it. Those things, I think, do go away eventually or get cycled out. Looking at a lot of these really popular cards from Commander Legends, you know, that land cycle is not going to be phased out of decks anytime soon. Things like Jessica's Will or Akroma's Will aren't going to be going away anytime soon. The court cycle, for example, they're probably not going to be printing better versions of cards, but the Monarchy into the game in that exact way anytime in the near future. You know, I'm a big fan of War Room. I just feel like this is in particular a set filled with a bunch of cards that you're not just trying out. They feel like permanent additions to decks. So I'll be really interested long term to see what the staying power of some of these sets are too.
Now, Dana, it's almost like you might be hinting at something else that we want to do with all of the data that we've collected here. Because yeah, these were just the 1 month windows. That's something we definitely need to hit upon again as we're rounding out the show. This was just the immediate impact, but not all of the sets may have the same longevity. So we are also interested in some potential follow-up show, who knows, in seeing which of the sets had the best staying power over the course of, like, yeah, that is something that we might be hinting at for a future show, who knows? Because yes, there are plenty that could fall off, and seeing the sets that don't could be pretty interesting.
I'm excited.
Well, guys, now that we've sort of teased out that potential future episode, I think it's probably time that we call this episode to a close. So thank you guys for joining me. And if our listeners want to get in touch with us, where is it that they can find us all? Matt?
So you can find me on the Twitters at Mathimus55. That's MathImus55. And don't forget, twitch.tv/EDHRecCast. Wednesday evenings, we are playing games with guests each and every week. This coming week, we actually have the one and only, the progenitor of the format. Not progenitus of the format, but progenitor, the Sheldon Mannery.
And Dana.
You can find me on the Twitterbirds at Dana Roach. You can hear me once a week on my other podcast, CMDR Central. And I am writing articles once a month for EDH Rec and for Commander's Herald. You can also find all of us at patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter, and you can find the cast at EDH RecCast on Facebook and on Twitter as well. Plus, if you've got a question for us or some keen insight into the data on EDH Rec, you can contact us at EDHRecCast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to the whole team at the Command Zone Podcast for handling the post-production work on our podcast, and our thanks go out to our sponsors for the show. They are TCG Player and CardKingdom.com. You can find them using the price info links on EDH Rec, or you can visit CardKingdom.com/EDHREC to show your support for the show. Listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.